When Jeremy Baylinson talks about avatars, he's not talking about the 10-foot-tall blue creatures who inhabit Pandora, though the vision of James Cameron is not that far off from what you might see today. In virtual worlds like Second Life and the World of Warcraft, users virtually inhabit bodies radically different from their own, gaining powers that far exceed the constraints of reality. Jeremy Baylinson of Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab spends his days studying human beings and how they engage with avatars and virtual worlds. And it turns out, according to Baylinson's experiments, people don't just turn to their avatars as an escape from reality. When people come away from the avatar experience and re-engage with the real world, they take a little bit back from the virtual world with them. For instance, people who virtually chow down on a fake feast as their avatars actually experience the feeling of being full in real life. Young children, when shown digitally manufactured images of themselves swimming around with fish, will have false memories of the experience as if it had actually happened. When two human-controlled avatars are pitted against each other in a negotiation, the avatar depicted as taller will usually win the argument, regardless of the actual height difference between the real folks behind the avatars. These kind of experiments raise questions about trust, honesty, and representation, questions that we can expect to encounter as our interactions become more and more virtual. Who exactly is behind the avatar that coaxes me to run another mile on the treadmill at the gym? And why do they look and sound vaguely like the angry Russian fencing coach I had in college? And if an avatar can take advantage of what it knows about me to change my behavior in one way, could avatars also be designed to get me to buy, date, vote, and feel in a completely predetermined way? Judith Dunneth sat down with Jeremy after a recent talk he gave to the Law Lab at the Berkman Center to chat about some of his lab's experimentation and what it means for the future of human interaction.
I did my PhD at Northwestern University studying cognitive science and cognitive psychology, and I loved the research process, and I love the big idea about modeling behavior and predicting behavior and studying how humans interact with others. But at the time, I was studying modeling of cognitive processes, and I wasn't in love with the topic. And so I figured if I'm working 80 hours a week in the lab, I should really, really love what I'm doing. At the time, I was reading a lot of science fiction, in particular, what I consider to be the Bible of this work, which is Neuromancer, written by William Gibson. And I thought that if one was going to pursue an exciting part of cognitive science, it wasn't so much going to be artificial intelligence, which is what I was working on then, but really more this idea of virtual selves and virtual identities.
So you mentioned Gibson, sort of somewhat simultaneous with his writing was Snow Crash. And one of the things in Snow Crash, there's a point where they say the heights of the avatars had to be tied to people's actual heights. That was a law in that world. As you're starting to study how important things like heights are and the ways these things change online, how do you see this being in any way technologically regulated? Do you see it losing its meaning in the virtual world? Where do you see things like how I might choose to depict myself playing out over time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So on the one hand, you can think about when you put your credit card number online. You know, 10 years ago, if I would have said, Judith, can you email me your credit card number? I'm going to put it on a website. You would never have done it. This idea of putting yourself out there and of being able to tie yourself to such personal information was unheard of on the web a decade ago. But now people enter their credit card numbers without a thought all over the place because we can do a pretty good job of ensuring a one-to-one tie between your credit card and the entry of your credit card, the person that owns the card and the entry that occurs. So we've kind of figured out financial information digitally tied to its owner, not without its crises, of course. We have those. The question is, when we're talking about identity, things, how you look, how you're behaving, your height, your gender, your age, are we going to regulate that in the same way that one regulates financial information? And on the one hand, you take ideas that I know that you talked about probably 15 years ago, maybe 20, the ideas that Sherry Turkle was talking about, which is that you know, identity is free in these digital spaces. And that on the one hand, this is going to, the having a virtual self is going to free us from the constraints of age and from appearance and all these horrible superficial things that tend to bind us. We get to play with these identities in these spaces. And, you know, you've got your ideal self compared to your actual self. And so on the one hand, these spaces are wonderful forums for you to abandon the physical. On the other hand, there's certain times where you're probably going to want to know. When you're on an online dating situation, you're probably going to want to know the actual sex of the person behind the avatar. And the question is, how stringently are we going to tie identity features and appearance features to the avatar? You know, I have no answers to that. I mean, it's fascinating that, you know, in Snow Crash, they chose to make that a rule. We'll see.
It's a fascinating question. I think the dating world is a somewhat different one because it ultimately, it's a portal to a real life exchange. So your ties to your real world self are a little bit different. A lot of the interesting dating material says it's not so much getting that first date, it's that once you meet, there's a certain discrepancy that's good. Sure. But also Dan Ariely has looked at that. You have to get that first date, but mm-hmm. you can't show up completely different.
Right.
But in other spaces, you have more freedom. And one of the other pieces of research, somewhat far afield, this made me think of, is research with sparrows who are given false badges of status. Mm. And it's somewhat controversial in the signaling world, but that when you had low status sparrows who were painted with high status badges, they were initially treated as if they were high status sparrows and then punished for being presumptuous. High status.
So they were detected. They were detected.
Yes, yeah. Because of other subtleties in their behavior. Have you looked at any of these issues with the discrepancies, maybe less in height, but discrepancies in people's behavior and their self-image and how they appear?
Yeah, so that's there's a lot I can talk about with that, and I love that sparrow example. That's fantastic. With the mimicry studies we discussed, so if I'm intentionally mimicking your behavior to gain advantage, the 5% of people that did consciously detect it, the mimicry then becomes mockery. So when the signal is when the breach of the signal is detected, then it backfires in a big way. We don't like, once we detect that someone's consciously trying to game the system, we certainly punish those transgressors. They worked in the mimicry studies, in the face morphing studies. If you tell someone that the picture's been manipulated, the effects go away. So I think that we're very much like the sparrows in that sense, that when the signal is, when we believe it to be pure, then we operate as such. But once we know that it's not, that we don't. I mean, and then the fascinating thing becomes, we know in the virtual world. On the other hand, I don't want to keep going back to this dating example, but the Second Life, the people in Second Life that are having sex know in some sense of the word that the person behind that avatar is not beautiful like the avatar, is probably not female, but they're still willing to suspend that disbelief. And the question is, online, are there different rules for signals? I don't think so. It's interesting.
It's another place where we're forced to think about, when do we want to suspend belief? I think it's an important thing for anyone working on honesty to think about, is that very often we're not interested in honesty at all. I do not go into a restaurant really hoping for an honest opinion from the waiter about what they think of my clothes or me or my friends.
Sure.
You go to have an experience where they tell you, welcome, it's so good to see you, what a brilliant choice. Yeah, and we know that that person's probably thinking, oh, another group of five women, they never leave tips, I hate it, I wish I'd just go, right? But I don't want to know that.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of it is that in places like the online world, we're forced to confront, because it's so stark, how often what we are interested in is the surface. Certainly phone sex lines work, because people want to suspend belief. So another case where I think some of those boundaries between what do we want to know and what do we not want to know in terms of the ethics, that's interesting. I don't know quite the way to phrase it, but the features that give us power that are earned features versus unearned ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the reasons the height seems to resonate very much, is that in a sort of democratic, everyone should start with the same abilities society, it seems terribly unfair that somebody's genetics would give them such a tremendous example because their femur grew really long and someone else's did not.
Right.
And so there's a level where that may be a celebrated equalizer to be able to do online, whereas some of the other features about how somebody behaves, maybe things that have to do with what they've learned and sort of have earned a place. Mm-hmm. And to be able to just mimic that seems somewhat more unfair. Do you see any spaces where that division comes up in your work?
Well, I love the big point, which is some of the stuff we're born with and some of it we make ourselves. You know, with the height example, you know, people who have, you know, men who are short in the physical world who have lived with it all their life come up with ways to compensate for it. Women do the same things with different features. What's fascinating is when you put them in the virtual world and you take someone who's normally has never had to overcome those features and you quote unquote handicap them with that, that's where you get the big effect. The fascinating question is if you give them time to then learn to adjust for it, what happens? And no one's really done the longitudinal study. One study I didn't talk about today was we ran in this Second Life study, we had them spend 10 hours a week for 6 weeks in an avatar, and we assigned people, 1/4 of our subjects were assigned to obese avatars. We made them as large as could possibly be given the constraints of the programs of Second Life. And anecdotally, qualitatively, the strongest data we have from that study was the trauma to be not beautiful in a world where beauty is free is a painful experience for people. And the subjects who were forced to spend 6 or 8 hours a week in these obese avatars had a really tough time with it. And how that relates to the earned versus not earned one, I'm sure there's a connection there somewhere. The other example with the earned, not earned one that's raising to me is in games like World of Warcraft, where there's a specific marker of success, which is what level you've earned to. Unlike the physical world, or maybe it is somewhat like the physical world, players will farm out their characters and have other people, quote unquote, level up. Meaning every level in World of Warcraft, I gain more powers. I can pay someone, you know, so oftentimes in a different country to play my character while I'm working all day and come back and I'm leveled up and I've got this marker of success when my avatar did it, but I didn't. And then there's this question of, yes, my avatar earned it, but I wasn't behind my avatar when the earning took place. And that takes it to a whole different level, which is the avatar earned the rights, but me powering the avatar did not. You know, a lot of the stuff when you've got an avatar, these definitions that are often clean, say with sparrows, it's unclear even philosophically whether or not it should be me. So in that example, with someone who pays someone to level up, the avatar certainly deserves it. But do I deserve it as the guy who's paying for the avatar and breaks the rationality of it in some ways?
Yeah, and again, we see examples of that even in the sporting world and the way, for instance, car racing has divided between saying all drivers get equal cars and we want to test the best driver versus different, you can fix up your car all you want.
Sure, sure.
And then you match drivers to them, but did the driver or the car win?
Yeah,
does the jockey or the horse win? Another place where these questions come in are questions about all kinds of steroids and enhancements in sports when we're trying to figure out what is it that we want to believe won.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I mean, why is it that, you know, a surgery that makes me stronger after my rotator cuff is repaired is okay, but steroids is not.
Right. And there's the question of what's being honest, and there's the question of if there's a doctor who can potentially cure a disease, do we want to allow them to take performance enhancing drugs? Do we want to require that they take performance enhancing drugs?
Right.
So I think there's a lot of related pieces here. You know, and thinking also when you mentioned the obese avatars, I think it's interesting too that we struggle so much, for instance, in corporations to find ways to essentially level people. You get this tiny office, you sit here in these boardrooms, and I think some of what you're pointing out are the ways that something like Second Life tries to simply imitate how we do things now, and it always seems kind of funny. There's chairs and there's spaces, but I think what you're pointing to is a future where a lot of these divisions might be made at the level of the avatar.
Mm-hmm.
With the political ones, which seem sometimes sort of the most discussed of your work, here we're talking about work of taking a picture of a politician, morphing it with a subject, and if you put elements of the subject's face into the politician's face, people find them more persuasive and trustworthy. What is your sense about, do you think this is something that, for instance, campaigns will pick up on?
Well, I can answer that in a practical manner and in an ethical manner. Mm-hmm. In a practical manner, absolutely. I mean, it's, when I first started doing this, well, this work's actually fairly old. It's been about 6 years since we've our first study on this. And take a battleground state like Ohio in a presidential election where there's probably 200, 300,000 people that are going to really matter when it comes to swinging the state based on various districts. Putting people in a room, you know, political volunteers, it takes about 15 minutes to morph a face. You can get all of their pictures from driver's license databases or from other places. You know, 15 minutes per face, a room full of 100 people that works for a month. It's not inconceivable that everyone gets mailed, snail mailed, a physical flyer that's got a printout of this morphed picture at all in these really critical states. From a pragmatic standpoint, even physically, forget digitally, I think that it's feasible. Now, as I said, this software that we use is 7 or 8 years old, and you know we're not engineers. We're not the MIT Media Lab who's got access to all these brilliant people. You could automate this. We haven't, but it's certainly possible that people could do this quite easily in an automated fashion, in which case it becomes even more practical. From an ethical standpoint, this gets back to what we were talking about during the talk, which is there a line that's crossed, or is it just more of the same? So when Hillary Clinton goes down to the South and throws a drawl in her voice because she wants to make herself more like the demographic, is morphing your face any different than that? Or when George Bush, when he speaks to oil barons, he dresses one way. When he goes to the blue collar factory, he dresses another way. Is that kind of tailoring unethical? And, you know, it's unclear if you're crossing a line or if it's more of the same. And you can say, well, you know, it seems to me that stealing someone's face just feels creepy. And I agree with that. But does stealing someone's accent, and at that point you're not stealing a person's accent, you're stealing a demographic's accent. So right now politicians work very hard to tailor to the demographic. What the digital technology allows them to automatically tailor to the individual as opposed to the demographic. And yeah, I've never heard any moral outcry about tailoring to the demographic. Is there something qualitatively different with tailoring to the individual? And I count on ethicists at the Berkman Center to answer that question for me.
I think one of the ethical lines, though, that you do draw is in the actual performance. And that might be one piece from the ethical standpoint where if I put a drawl in my voice, mm-hmm. one of the things that people are hearing is that, yes, it's not true that I'm actually Southern, but it's true that I have bothered to listen to how Southerners speak mm-hmm. and to speak like them. It's a way of mimicking. It's a way of showing, yes, I'm here. I'm listening to what you're doing. I am sort of, I'm willing to work things through your mores and your ways of doing it. If it is done automatically, as these pieces are, I haven't had to do anything. Mm-hmm. I have not mm-hmm. had to perform any level of empathy. Gotcha. So it's without any personal performance. So I don't know that the distinction is between the group and the individual, but between the performance of it and a digital mimicry where the politician themselves did not.
So it's about putting out the effort.
Yes.
Okay, I can buy that as a distinction. So going with that, if the Hillary Clinton had an automatic voice filter that no matter every person in the audience had their earphones on, they had an RFID tag that told them the zip code, and the voice was differently depending on the license location, that would be abusive.
That would be
given the
standard, other line.
Given the standard, yeah, abusive is the wrong word, but right. That would be south of our line.
It could be, and then it makes you then ask interesting questions about what happens, for instance, in large-scale diplomatic experiences, what might we want to look at more closely about what translators do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
For instance.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of this work, I think, raises questions that people haven't really thought about as much to say, well, how does the exact accent of the translator matter? How do we want to really think about in the UN what they're doing and how they're mimicking different things mm-hmm. and what mm-hmm. kind of class is being forth? To what extent do they mimic the equivalent of the speaker versus the listener? So where do you, what are some of the big questions you see yourself looking at in the next few years?
I'll tell you what I'm very excited about right now, and that is using one's avatar to very viscerally show him or her the carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. So everyone knows that certain behaviors are bad for the environment. And a lot of people most people, I would say, are pretty pro doing things that are better for the environment. Take your well-informed person like you or I. We probably both think that we're pretty much better than the next person in terms of our carbon footprint. And I think that if you look at every single person, most people believe they're better than average in terms of their behaviors. What we can do with virtual reality is that we can, in a very visceral manner, show someone their action on the environment. So let me give you an example. New York Times ran a really provocative piece about toilet paper. Toilet tissue, which is if you get that really soft toilet tissue, the stuff that we all love when we see it in the bathroom, you have to use virgin trees to do that. So in order to use that really nice toilet paper, you're literally causing people to cut down big, large virgin trees. So this story came out, and you know there was an outcry for a couple of days, but it didn't change sales of this toilet paper much. Imagine a simulation where you're in the virtual store and you choose to grab this brand of toilet paper, the high-end stuff, and you put it in your cart. All of a sudden, you're immediately beamed into the forest, and your arms are taken out of your control, and you're forced to watch yourself saw down this virgin tree. You know, doing this while guided by scientific principles, meaning not just being alarmist about it, really showing some of the science behind it, really showing somebody viscerally the link between their actions and the impact on the environment, and showing it by showing themselves being the ones doing it, can be really powerful in showing some of the link with his own behavior. So we've got a lot of simulations like that, even ranging from something to just having a cloud wherever you go, having a cloud of carbon molecules that follows you based on what you've been doing. So we're all using these digital devices. You could imagine a simulation that overrides your behavior such that everything that you do, you know, you can't look at your BlackBerry without seeing those number of carbon molecules that are bouncing around based on whether you chose to drive or work that day, or if you left your heat on by accident in your house. So really using virtual reality as a way of highlighting and educating people about their own impact on the environment.
I mean, it seems like with this, and you had talked earlier about weight loss pieces, is this a lot within the range of using it to help people do things they want to be doing but aren't motivated enough to do, to give them, it's a sort of a visceral motivation?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that in the abstract sound great to us, but, you know, there's a lot of impacts that we have that even as informed people, we're not aware of. So on the one hand, it educates us about things we had no idea about. So is because I'm ordering this special fruit that's got to be shipped from a place, there's repercussions in the environment that we have no idea about in terms of how shipping and trucking and storing and air conditioning are working. So your decision to buy those really nice pears that are only grown in that certain state have huge ramifications on the carbon footprint, but we don't know about that. So on the one hand, it's just purely educational in the sense of making the what's abstract very out in the open. But then there's the second step, which you just alluded to, which is even when I know I'm supposed to do something. So for example, and I'm not trying to be high and mighty here. I'm as bad as the next person with this stuff. You know, you're upstairs already and you're already tucked in, and you just all of a sudden realize you left that light on downstairs, or you left the heat on, you know, 69 where it probably should be down to 65, 64. And, you know, there's little things that even though we know we're supposed to do it, we're not truly aware of the big impact that the lack of those actions have. So really tying our actions into the consequences.
You had mentioned the talk, some work you were doing, particularly in Second Life, and being able to look at data about what people were doing in Second Life, knowing who they were in the real world, and using that to basically train a system so that it could look at Second Life behavior and be able to predict quite well all kinds of demographic information about the person. Can you talk a little bit about where that work is going? I certainly see, I mean, one of the things I find interesting is that it has huge repercussions as a method outside of the realm of virtual reality. You talked earlier about avatars being anything about you. It seems that email and all kinds of pieces could be used in that.
So the Reynard proposal was specifically based on, for security issues, can we detect a certain type of person based on what they've done online? And by certain type of person, it can be an angry person. You can be looking for gender. You can be looking for a person from a specific country. In order to frame the basic science, because this was a basic science proposal, they challenged scientists to come up with a model that could predict male or female based on a digital footprint. And they challenged people to do this in a cross-cultural context. So it wasn't just college kids, and it was people from a number of countries. As far as I know, they gave grants to four separate groups, each one very interdisciplinary, very widespread. And so there's four separate projects going on trying to predict whether you're male or female based on this mass of data you leave when you're in an online virtual world. And this call in particular from the IARPA was based on using these graphical 3D virtual worlds, though you are quite right that there's a ton of people. There's a, Jeff Hancock, who you bring in later on, he does stuff with language. What can you predict? Be sure and ask him about his great work on predicting psychotics versus not psychotics, deceivers versus not deceivers based on their language. That's based on there's great work by a guy named Jamie Pennebaker down at University of Texas, who does a lot of this stuff. So just from what you say, you can predict this. But what we're getting now is, in addition to getting the verbal layer, you get the nonverbal layer. And it's just, so with our data that we ran, we separated demographic information, you know, how old you were, your gender, where you were from, things like that, your weight, with personality stuff. And it turned out that with demographics, your nonverbal stuff, your nonverbal tracking data was more important predictor than your verbal. So if I wanted to predict whether or not you were male or female, or whether you are Latina or Caucasian, your nonverbal behavior was a better predictor. If I wanted to predict your personality, such as your self-esteem or how neurotic you were, your language was a better predictor. So I think there's a time and a place for this, using the nonverbal stuff you get for online stuff from online worlds, but also using just the verbal data you can get from the web, from email, has a huge, huge role as well.
Well, have you looked at the difference between how well you predict these things versus a human observer?
Not yet. This is all brand new for us as a lab. I do believe there's some things the human's going to be better than the computer at, and some things the computer will be better than the human at. What we're at a brand new phase that we've never been at before as scientists is that if you're trying to train a system to have these subtle recognition of patterns that humans were always better at, mm-hmm. beforehand, what we'd never had was such a detailed, what we call an input layer, meaning the computers, when you're in a virtual world, collect so much data about you that we're in a spot that we've never been at before, because humans pick up on lots of subtle patterns that it's hard to program a computer. But given enough time, and the computer is often going to find those patterns. And now we're just getting to be at the point where the computer, the virtual world tracking systems, almost give the computer an edge on the human simply because it collects more data than the human is capable of perceiving over time.
Right. Well, I think it has an edge also because I was coincidentally just reading one of Susan Herring's papers on gender online, mm-hmm. and how people detect it. And her conclusion is that people tend to be very easily fooled by highly stereotypical behavior.
Sure.
So that if someone goes online and they really overact, they're much more like a drag queen than a woman, people will identify them as a woman, whereas they don't do as well with people who aren't overacting. And that we tend to be much more fooled by these very, very stereotypical behaviors and not by the much more robust but more subtle markers.
Yeah.
So the computer is perhaps be much better.
Right. So humans often become extremely overconfident once they make an initial judgment and are trapped by that. Mm-hmm. And computers can do that too, but you can actually program the computer to be more conservative in its judgments and avoid what they call those local minimums.
Right. Well, I think your work is also just a fascinating level for thinking about the deeper meaning of what digital literacy is going to mean in terms of being able to read people, of being able to read signals, of being able to understand behavior. And really, what does it mean to be able to move in these world with an understanding of the subtlety of what's going on in them?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something we all need to work on, myself more than many.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeremy Bailenson is the founding director of Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. You can find out more about their work, catch a talk by Jeremy, and find links to video from Jeremy's recent appearance on PBS's Frontline by visiting us on the web at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with Judith Dunneth at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.